This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Michael Monks. Later in the program, we'll talk about Cincinnati's increased deadly shooting numbers and a new marketplace series called The Economy, What Now? First, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. I talked with him yesterday about a number of issues Cincinnati City Council dealt with this week. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Marianne.
So this whole streetcar situation has been something since June. And I want to sort of talk about what happened in June and how that's affecting what's happening now and then what has to, or is likely to happen again in September. So can you sort of chronologically take us through what's been happening with the streetcar since June?
Yeah, it's been something since 2013 sometimes, I feel like. But yeah, since June. So what happened, obviously, the city's budget is a mess because of the COVID-19 crisis. They had a major deficit that started out somewhere around $90 million. And so they, you know, they were looking at ways to balance the budget. And the streetcar is kind of a separate item. It's not in the general fund. And initially, the mayor proposed that the streetcar should basically run without passengers. They would spend about $3 million to do that. Basically, it would be maintained and, you know, you'd run it every once in a while to kind of keep it fresh. But basically that for the next, you know, 12 months from June to June of 2021, that it would not run with passengers. And so there were members of council that felt that was not a good practice. They felt it was wasteful to spend $3 million and not actually have anybody on the streetcar for it. And what they came up with initially was the transit fund that the city has. It collects a 0.3% earnings tax to fund the Metro bus service and some other miscellaneous items. And there's projected to be, you know, there's always usually some surplus in that fund. And so they decided that they should spend $1.5 million to kind of round out the streetcar budget and allow it to run full time.
Now,
where we started in June.
I want to clarify one thing. Now, with that streetcar fund, that transit fund goes away, doesn't it, after because of the vote, once they start collecting the Metro tax? Okay. So the money's there right now, but that money's not going to be there indefinitely.
Right. It's going to be a one-time thing. Issue 7 passed, and in October, the city earnings tax for transit goes away, and it's replaced by the countywide sales tax for transportation.
Okay. So back onto our timeline here. So what did the council then decide in June?
So a supermajority with a bipartisan number of members voted to spend the $1.5 million from the transit fund. The mayor vetoed that ordinance, and because there was a month lag between council meetings, regular council meetings, they did not meet to reconsider that veto until Wednesday, when they overrode that veto. But they also passed another source of funding. As we all know, the mayor didn't like the use of the transit fund for the streetcar, so they came up with another source of funding. This was the Downtown Over the Rhine Tax Increment Financing District, which is another special fund that the city had. And the city has extra money in that fund that could be used this one time to basically pay for the streetcar. Now, it's kind of indirect. The fund has to be used for a general fund expense, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to move that money into funding some public safety items. And the money that funded the public safety items, that will fund the streetcar under the ordinance they passed. Now, Mayor Cranley also vetoed that ordinance on
that was
on
this
Wednesday.
Week, right. So that's vetoed,
week, right.
And they don't meet again now until September.
Correct. So if they want to actually use that TIF money, they'll have to come back in September and override that veto.
But what happens in the meantime if somebody wants to ride the streetcar? Is it going to start running again?
It is supposed to start running later this month. I think they thought it would take maybe 3 weeks to get it restarted, so maybe 20, 21 days. That's at least the initial estimate. So we should see a running streetcar relatively soon. There is one little wrinkle, as there usually is. The mayor brought up the notion that maybe the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, which runs the Metro bus system, might he brought up the idea that somebody might sue the city over this use of the transit fund. We were kind of left to infer that it was sort of, but not completely sure about that. So that's kind of where it stands. Should run in about 3 weeks, but you know, you never know with this issue.
So it's supposed to start in 3 weeks. Nobody has to pay to get on. Is that right?
Right. The budget will allow for it not to charge fares. This was a thing that has kind of been on the wish list of streetcar supporters for a long time. They point out that the cost of collecting fares, which includes the maintenance of the credit card machines and the fees associated with credit cards and the enforcement of the fares, that it nearly cost as much to enforce the fares as it did to charge them. So their argument was, let's just make it free. And that should also improve ridership, although I'm not sure that'll be the case given the lack of people downtown at this point.
And what about the protocols for safety in the middle of a pandemic? Are they going to do similar things to what they're doing on the buses? What's the plan? Do they even talk about that?
They didn't talk about it in much detail. I do know that Transdev, the third-party contractor that the city has hired to run the streetcar, they have some pretty strict cleaning protocols. I can't describe the technicalities of that, but I think they are as good as the Metro buses, if not better.
Let's move to the banks. Actually, there's supposed to be a park at the banks, but there seems to be all kinds of trouble between the county and the city about who's going to do what, how it's going to get started. Mayor Cranley and the commissioners have gone back and forth on this and don't seem to be getting anywhere. What is the status of this new project at the banks?
Well, the music venue, as you can see if you go down there, it's under construction. It's rising from the ground. It's going to be complete. The issue is the rest of the banks. The park that is going to be adjacent to the music venue, that has not been, that's not been constructed or started yet. And then you have the issue of the other lots that are vacant right now. So the city, the mayor and the late Commissioner Todd Fortun cut a deal back last November where the city would get to develop the lots closest to Paul Brown Stadium that are just north of it, while the county would get to develop some of the other lots that it owns. And the problem has been the fine print. The city has issues with a couple of things. The first is the park itself. It wants to have basically more control over how the park is built. And the other issue is it wants to be able to build on the lots closest to Paul Brown Stadium that it owns, that the city owns, without necessarily having the county build parking garages, which has kind of been the practice in the past. This was a way to kind of pass money from one part of the banks to the other, is by building these parking garages and using the revenue to help out the next phase. And so the county says it's fine with the city, of course, building on those lots, but it needs to be made financially whole. And so this week what happened was there was a dispute over the park, basically, and the city said, well, we don't like the terms that the city is, or that the county is offering, so we just want them to assign us the contract to build the park, and we'll build it ourselves. And the county basically said, we don't have time for this. We have a contract to build that park. We need to lock in the pricing, and so we're going to just go ahead and build it without the city signing off on the contract, which is what had needed to have happened last week. So now you have a situation where you have both governments saying they're going to build this park, but the fact of the matter is the county owns the land that's underneath it. So the county may have the upper hand there. We will see.
So are we just waiting?
One thing happened yesterday. Yep. Well, what we're waiting is for maybe some further discussion. The city and the county are talking about having a joint meeting on this topic in the next couple of weeks. We're waiting to see that date and time finalized.
Okay. Well, one other thing we wanted to talk with you about.
That's how I feel about it.
Well, I'm just trying to keep it all straight because it's a little confusing. I mean, that who owns what and who's in charge of what and how it all works together. And, of course, Todd Fortun isn't with us anymore. So whatever was agreed to there's been some disagreements over what they believe each side believes that agreement was, correct? So there's confusion.
It's massively confusing and complicated. Absolutely.
Let's go to another confusing topic, or at least maybe a little confusing. The FC Cincinnati soccer stadium is being built in the West End, and construction was halted this week, and not because of weather and not because of materials problems, but because of racism. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Right. The contractor, the general contractor who's overseeing the construction of the West End Stadium, Turner Construction, basically what they said happened over the course of a few days last week was there were apparently a couple of racist incidents, is the words that they used, by four people who were working for subcontractors on the job. And so at this point, Dave Spaulding, the vice president of Turner, said, we're stopping work, and we're going to do some anti-bias training, some racial sensitivity training for every worker on the project. There's about 400 workers on the project, so that's a major undertaking. And Spaulding said he intends to have every single worker have that training before they resume construction. So I asked Spaulding, I was like, is this common to have this? And there have been racial problems in the construction industry previously, so this is not necessarily unusual to have whatever these incidents were. But he said it is unusual for you to stop work completely. And so he feels like they're making a good faith effort to really address the situation.
So he's trying to send a message with this, I would imagine, to both the workers and to the community. Is that the impression you got?
Absolutely. They're trying to say we take this seriously, and we're not this behavior wasn't acceptable. Kind of the unfortunate thing is we don't really know what happened. We have no idea. They said they could not disclose that to us, at least at the point we reported the story earlier this week. So the details are a bit of a mystery.
And the subcontractors are the ones that were accused of this racist incident. You said there were four of them. Those people are no longer, they're not even going through the training. They're just not involved anymore. Is that right?
That is correct. They have been moved off the job. We also don't know the identity of the subcontractor, so we're not sure exactly who this was that committed these acts, whatever they were.
Now, will this training, did they give you any details? Are they going to do it online? Are they going to do it in person? I mean, how do they set that up? Do you have any indications?
So what he told me about it was that they have a third party coming in. I don't remember the name of it, but that they have a third party coming in to develop the training, and then that Spaulding, he will help train the employees personally with the consultant. And so I think that, I assume the training will be done on site because everybody's there anyway. But I'm not completely sure about that.
And you have no idea when the construction is going to start up again?
They said that the training was going to take about 2 hours, but if you have 400, 450 employees, I assume that everybody's not going to be doing it on the same day. But I don't think they believe it's going to hold it up for weeks, but I'm not sure whether construction has restarted yet.
Do you know if that project's on time?
I believe it is so far. I don't know how much of an effect this will have on it. FC Cincinnati did issue a statement about this itself where they said that they're not going to tolerate racism on the job site either, and that they support what Turner Construction is doing. So even if there is a delay, FC is kind of saying, hey, this is worth it because we think this issue is important.
And I guess at this point, they don't know when they can play in that stadium anyway.
Right. Nobody's really playing in any stadiums. I mean, the MLS season is kind of in a bubble down in Florida, but nobody's able to attend those games as far as I understand.
Well, Chris, it's been a busy week. Anything else we've missed that's critical?
I don't think so. I think we've covered most of it, Marianne. I mean, there was also some development projects, a major project in downtown Madisonville, the Cincinnati neighborhood. That kind of ran into some turbulence with some neighborhood opposition, but it ended up passing council on Wednesday.
All right, so you get a little break now since council's not meeting for a month or so.
That's correct. Yeah, it'll be nice to take a little breather.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Appreciate it, Marianne. Thanks for your time.
I've been talking with reporter and columnist with the Cincinnati Business Courier, Chris Wetterich, and I will point out that this interview was recorded on Thursday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. Reports out this week show Cincinnati is on a pace for a record number of killings in the city this year. Joining me to talk about the statistics, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge. You can call 513-419-7100 with your questions. Email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Marianne. You know I'm going to be off the whole rest of the day and just feel like now it's early in the morning.
That that's a good way to look at it. For me, it feels like it's nighttime already, I think. But it's been an interesting series of stories that you've done this week. And you did this one talking about the number of gun deaths, gun incidents in the city. Can you fill us in on what those statistics are right now?
You know, this is the one week where council is meeting and talking about a lot of things. And we have just, our homicides and shootings are on pace for a record year. And there was a presentation in Cincinnati Council's Law Committee talking about those numbers. I forget what the actual number is off the top of my head. I apologize.
Oh, no worries.
But if we stay on this pace, we're on pace to have the highest number on record.
Now, you talked with Assistant Police Chief Paul Newdegate about what all of this means. And what was his reaction to these numbers growing at the rate that they are right now?
So he was presenting to council, and, he knows these numbers inside and out. And this was a more than hour-long conversation between council and himself, and he answered all the questions I definitely would have asked. He was talking about just this violence is happening. The Cincinnati police are not out really embedded in the community because of the coronavirus, as they have in the past, and getting the kind of, intel and understanding what's going on the streets as they had in the past. And he also said there's still some work to be done. After these protests, there's some people in the community that are upset with the police. And he talked about, it's like a little, after years of all these improvements with the collaborative, and he said they're working on it, but those were the reasons that he cited for this.
Well, let's talk about some of those concerns that people have. And we all know that there have been plenty of protests, many protests throughout the city related to police, some calling for defunding the police, which lots of people seem to have different definitions of. Some call that removing all funding from the police departments. Others say take some of that funding and put it into social services to help some of the people that have some concerns where police are dealing with people that they aren't trained to deal with. So there's all kinds of talk there. What are you hearing about what that relationship with the police? Paul Newdegate, during one of the protests, actually, I believe, met with some of the protesters. And after that meeting, things settled down a little bit.
Agree. I mean, he's really reaching out and has been the face of this and been on the streets for everything. But, this is where the conversation at council really made me decide to write about it. Because Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, one of the council women, she brought up this issue of defunding the police. And, of course, really means, like, putting these, social service issues kind of like, well, is this a mental health issue? Is that kind of thing, this conversation going to be evolving in city council for sure? But she brought that up as just kind of in passing to note that. And I have to say, Assistant Chief Newdegate, he agreed with that, and he said that he would welcome that help. But then he said, part of the problem is there are super predators on Cincinnati streets. And that term is a 90s term, and it's been very controversial over the years with this idea that people are killing without remorse. And it's not like he didn't know what he was saying. He really meant it. He said, in my 31 years of policing, this is what I'm seeing right now. And we can have social services and we can help some people. And he said, but the people who are these super predators have to be locked away. And that is what is going to reduce gun violence. And he was very serious. And that was in direct response to Jan Michelle Lemon-Kearney saying, well, there need to be social services too.
Well, it's interesting. The term super predator came from Hillary Clinton back when she was first lady and talking during her husband's administration. And there was a lot of criticism for that. What can you really define that term a little bit more and talk about what he had to say about these people that he calls super predators?
Well, I had to do some research, even though I remembered the term. I didn't remember the origin. There was a very well-regarded social scientist who came up with this term and this theory that there was this whole new generation of people committing crime without remorse, and they were juveniles, and this was his whole theory. And this is when the crime bill was being passed, like 1994, 1996, and Hillary Clinton, as the first lady, was defending the crime bill and talking about it, and she used this term and really put it out into like this whole, it made it in the general conversation, it really sparked like a whole nationwide look at what was going on. Since then, a lot of that's been debunked. Even that social scientist has said, well, not all of that theory was right. That was just one theory. And it came up in Hillary Clinton when she was running for president in 2016. She was kind of confronted with using that term, and she actually apologized for using it. And it's, and that's part of that term's whole history remains out there. But Assistant Chief Newdigate, he knows all that. You know, he's, you know, does all of the policing research and knows what's going on. And he seems very concerned about what's happening on the street.
So did he have any suggestions or did he have any thoughts about what could be done to help bring this number? And we did, I did have my producer look up, or she kindly looked up. I said killings are up 27% from last year. There were 44 last year at this time, 56 this year. So that's what some of those
numbers are. We had another one this morning. There was a murder-suicide in East Price Hill. And honestly, when he came with the statistics on Monday morning, they weren't even up to date because there had been a homicide a few hours before in Avondale. I mean, this is very serious. We haven't seen this kind of all of these shootings and the homicides since 2015. And, you know, I brought, this did not come up in committee, but I brought it up into the conversation because people were talking about, well, what did we do then? The police chief, Jeffrey Blackwell, was fired for not getting a handle on things. He was given this whole 90-day. I mean, I think that your listeners and my readers remember this. This was one of the biggest things of 2015 in the city. Of all of the crime, there was a 90, he was put on this, like, you know, performance improvement plan, and you have to come up with a 90-day plan to fix the violence. And in September, then city manager Harry Black fired the police chief.
What do you
no
think?
No one is suggesting that now. But
I was going to say, is it to that point now, or do you think that there are going to be other steps taken to try to get this back under control?
Definitely no one is speaking of that now. The chief could not have more support, really, from council after things. You know, we did have a little bit of rioting that first weekend and unrest on some other nights. But people are widely praising the police department and the chief for their leadership.
And we should say it's Chief Elliot Isaac, for people that may not be aware,
yes.
And Assistant Chief
Newdigate. But they're putting police officers in hot spots, and there was definitely no solutions offered here. But if you read between the lines, you could tell it was like, don't take away overtime. You cannot defund us, even if you're going to do these social service things. Like, you could tell what he was getting at, and it's like, we're working on this, and don't hamper us, council, please.
One other story you wrote about this week were about two of the newest council members, Republican Betsy Sunderman and Democrat Jan-Michelle Lemon-Kearney. It turns out that despite the fact that they don't agree on a number of policy issues, they do seem to get along quite well. Tell us about that.
You know, it's actually refreshing. We've had just so much consternation on council. Between, you know, the people who were texting and then those not texting, and then we have the whole idea of there's been a lot of arguing, 2018 over Harry Black, and we have these two new councilwomen. They start in a pandemic, and I've watched over the last couple months, you can tell they're friends. They laugh together. You can see they're having conversations, like, after meetings, like, about their lives and their children. And so when of course I want to write about the new council people, but when I approached the story, I really approached it like that, and they embraced that, and they're like, oh my gosh, we're totally friends, we're doing all these new council things together. They went with them. They get to know the different departments, and so, you know, they went on a tour of this, and they did this other thing, and I went with them the day they did the kind of training the police officers go through to kind of understand that, right? They were both invited. They decided to do it together. And it was like two friends out, you know, together. And they were doing something very serious, of course.
Well, they were both at the shooting, the firing range, right?
Well, it's inside of the police academy where it's like a big firing range. But it was like virtual reality. I actually learned a lot myself and felt like maybe I should write a story that this is kind of training the officers do. They got to pretend to be police officers in these virtual reality situations. They were encouraging each other, and then when, you know, something happened, they would laugh together and like friends would. And so I think we're really seeing that, and I look forward to their relationship of going forward. And they definitely don't agree on things on council floor, but that's one spot, and in the rest of life, they're friends.
Do you think anything of that has to do with the fact that they both came on council at the same time? They were both the newbies together?
That has to be part of it, right? Because then here, and they both have children in school, which everyone's kind of grappling with, like, knowing what's best for your own family. So they have a lot of things in common, and that starts in common, too. And they're also, of course, the women on council. And so they have, I think, this baseline of things that could make them friends.
Well, Sherry, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, same. It was good talking to you.
All righty. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge. In just a moment, it's been a year since a mass shooting in Dayton, and Ohio's governor proposed changes in gun control. We'll talk about what's happened. Coming up.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. About a year ago, Dayton's Oregon district was shaken after a gunman killed 9 people. After the incident, when Ohio's governor came to speak at a vigil, the crowd shouted at him to do something. So what has been done since then? Joining me to talk about what's happened 1 year later is reporter from WYSO in Yellow Springs, Jason Reynolds. You can call 513-419-7100 with your questions. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Hi, Jason. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what has happened since that time. It's been about a year since that mass shooting, and after the calls for do something, has anything been done?
Well, no, absolutely nothing has been done, actually. There are over 30 bills just languishing in Ohio's House and Senate, not really going anywhere. The only thing recently that's been voted on was a bill in June that actually loosens gun restrictions a little bit. The House voted in favor of, now this hasn't gone to Senate yet, but they voted in favor of allowing a person with a concealed carry permit to not let a police officer know they have a gun until it's brought up or until they ask about it. So we really haven't seen any new gun control, despite having a lot of bills out there. The governor's 17-point plan and other pieces introduced, our legislation just doesn't want to move forward and vote on any of it.
What do you think is causing that? Is it just that the legislators are just not willing to even take a look at this? Did they have any kind of major discussion about any of these pieces of legislation?
Well, you know, a lot of them aren't interested in voting on it. They say they have reservations for one reason or another. I think there's a lot of concern from Second Amendment supporters that if you kind of a slippery slope argument, if you take away one thing, you take away them all. How is this going to affect our rights to own a gun? And while we have seen a little bit of sway, and now we see Republicans like DeWine, Republicans like State Senator Peggy Lehner jumping on board and wanting some sort of common sense gun reform, I think the majority of legislators still aren't interested and are still backing gun rights.
Well, let's talk about Senator Lehner. You included a lot of information from her in the story that you wrote. She's interested in universal background checks.
Yeah, and it's something she hears from her constituents in a lot. It's something we've seen a lot of studies come out from pro-gun control organizations like Ohioans for Gun Safety, Moms Demand Action, groups like that, where 80 to 90% of Ohioans, no matter what poll you take, say that they would approve of universal background checks. I've even spoken to owners of gun stores who would approve of background checks, universal background checks. Skip McGee, the owner of Mad River Armory and Range, says it actually hurts his business when, if he goes to sell at a gun show, he has to run a background check if you want to purchase a weapon off of him. But any Joe Schmo can rent a table and sell a gun right next to him, right, without running a background check. So it's not safe and it hurts his business, is his argument. So there's actually a lot of support for universal background checks. But most state legislators in Ohio aren't interested.
Has Senator Lehner worked with the fellow Republicans in an effort to try to get this going? Or has she just, is it just all still just lying there waiting for action?
I think she has. I think she just can't get people to work with her is what she told me. I know she's co-sponsored bills with other legislators, but she says the pro-gun, the pro-Second Amendment group of legislators and lobbyists are just too strong. They're hard to overcome. And they argue perhaps correctly in some areas. I think the further you go out from Dayton, the further you go out from the mass shooting where in areas, if you go stretch out to Cleveland, if you stretch out to Athens or Chillicothe, I think you see people who haven't been affected by it and don't feel the same way. There are a lot of people who are pro-Second Amendment.
When this all happened, and shortly after the governor was there, there were signs that popped up in a lot of yards in the Dayton area that said, do something. What is the mood in Dayton right now of the general public?
You know, I think there's a lot of disappointment. A lot of those signs have been replaced with Black Lives Matter sign. And it seems like it's maybe the region has moved on to the next issue of the day. And I think there's a sense of resignation, to be honest with you, among the people who wanted to see any sort of gun control. All these bills on December 31st, we end our 2-year General Assembly in Ohio. So all these bills that have been languishing will just vanish unless they're reintroduced. There's kind of a cleaning of the house that goes on. And so what we're going to see is nothing's going to happen. And the politicians I spoke to all agree nothing's going to happen. Barring some crazy sea change or another event that sparks action, all that's happened over the last year, at least for Ohio gun movement, will likely be for naught, though we have seen large groups appear on both sides on the state level. I think Moms Demand Action has become a real player. And also we see Buckeye Firearms on the Second Amendment side being a strong player, and Ohio gun owners, a more radical group that says they won't compromise at all about the Second Amendment, they're gaining steam too. So we see both sides kind of digging in their trenches, but we don't see anything getting done.
So even the governor has not been able to get anywhere with this.
No, he said as expected that it could be done, and he'd like to see something done. I think he's saying the things he has to say, but I think in his heart he knows nothing's going to change here.
What's the Oregon district like now? Is it back to whatever normal? I mean, I realize it's the pandemic, but I guess there is no real normal. But up until say February, was it back to business as usual?
It had, and it had seen a lot of support too. Prior to the mass shooting last August, tornadoes hit Dayton and shut down a lot of that area. There were urban tornadoes that shut down the area. Prior to that, there was a Klan rally in downtown Dayton, which also shut down downtown Dayton for a while. So those businesses had really, really been struggling. And we saw a lot of community support for the people in that area. One thing that was amazing was just the outpouring of care and consideration for the victims, for their families, and also for secondary victims like those businesses that lost so much money during such a volatile summer last year. Now I think they're struggling again with the pandemic. But what we see is a lot of people really aiming to help them. And it's been a really sweet thing. It kind of warms your heart to see people come in and help out those small businesses. It's really meant a lot to the community.
Jason, have I missed anything I should have asked you about all of this?
I don't think so. You know, I think I will say the reason that it sparked so much fury last year is because of how quick the response was. In this case, the police were on the block and the police were well-trained and they killed the shooter in 32 seconds, which is a half minute is a remarkable time to stop a mass shooter, which gives you the sense that the best we can do right now with a mass shooting, and the best case scenario is 9 dead and 3 dozen injured, which gives you an idea that no matter how good your security is, that's the best you'll possibly do. And I think that's why a lot of people have been calling for gun control.
Jason, thanks so much for talking with me.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with reporter from WYSO in Yellow Springs, Jason Reynolds. Yesterday afternoon, many were surprised to learn Ohio Governor Mike DeWine had tested positive for COVID-19. And then by last night, a second test showed he was negative. He's scheduled for a third test tomorrow. Here to help us sort through all that happened yesterday is Ohio State House correspondent Karen Kassler. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Marianne. How are you?
I'm good. You've been working a really long day or two here. Let's start out what happened yesterday afternoon. The governor was on his way to appear with President Trump, correct?
Right. He was supposed to appear on the tarmac with Lieutenant Governor John Houston to greet President Trump as he arrived for a fundraiser in Cleveland and then was headed to the Whirlpool factory in Clyde in Northeast Ohio. And everybody who comes near the president is administered a test to make sure that they don't have COVID. And he got a rapid test, and it was an antigen test, and it came back positive. And Lieutenant Governor John Houston's test came back negative. So DeWine left. Houston greeted the president along with a couple other folks. And DeWine came back to Columbus, where he went to Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, had a different kind of test. He, his wife, and the close staff members who are around him all the time all were tested. Those tests were actually run through two different platforms, and they came back negative. So now the question is, is he positive? Is he negative? Which test was right? He says he has confidence in the second set of tests from the Wexner Center. And so we're going to find out, hopefully tomorrow, what the next batch of tests show. And DeWine is doing a press conference at 2 o'clock where he's probably going to talk about this and other things.
Okay, so we should say we are bringing you that news conference live at 2 here on 91.7. But he's having another test tomorrow then, is that correct?
Right. And I think the whole idea is to try to figure out where is the discrepancy. And a statement he put out last night talked about exactly that, that he had shown some interest in trying to find some access to these rapid tests, because test results are really coming in very, very slowly for people who have been able to get them. Tests are hard to get in many cases, especially if you're asymptomatic. And those test results can come back in days. They can take weeks. And a rapid test can be a lot quicker, but a rapid test also can show more inaccurate results. And so DeWine had said he wanted to learn more about that. And then, of course, with this negative test result coming in last night, well, then we've got this discrepancy here that really makes people wonder whether the rapid test that the White House has been using is actually a test that can be relied upon.
Now, there's another issue, and you tweeted about this today, and I definitely want to talk about it because many, many people questioned, okay, so did he get counted in the count as being a COVID a person with COVID after that first test, even though now it looks like he may not have it? Can you tell us how that all worked into the count?
Right. Again, there's two different kinds of tests. The rapid test from the White House was an antigen test, and the Ohio Department of Health says that test is not used unless it's, first of all, that kind of test is not used in the daily count. It can only be considered a probable COVID test if it comes back positive, and there's other criteria, there are other symptoms that go along with that. The second test is the test that is commonly used. It's called a PCR test. That one would be counted if DeWine had come back as a positive with that. That would be listed in the state's overall count of positive tests. So that's the difference here, is there's two different kinds of tests. The antigen test, the rapid test that's not commonly used in Ohio and only could count as a probable if there were other symptoms involved, versus the PCR test, which is used. If it had been positive, that would be counted. So that's where that falls.
So the people that were critical of that then saying that's why the numbers in Ohio are as high as they are, that's not necessarily the case.
Well, but we do have a testing issue in Ohio. That's absolutely true. The idea that you can't just walk up and get a test. If you try to access testing through the retail sites that are on the state's website, you often are turned away if you don't have symptoms. And same with if you go to a health department, if you're not symptomatic, then you might be turned away. You can go to some urgent care centers. Those can take a long time for those results to come back. You can go to a pop-up testing site, which there were several down in Cincinnati, I believe, last week. But there's no guarantee that if you sit there in line that they won't run out of tests by the time they get to you. And when I tried to schedule a test earlier in the week just to kind of do an experiment here, I was told there is a national shortage of the reagent, the fluid that's used in the testing. And so that's part of the problem here. DeWine has joined with governors of some other states to create a compact where those governors will try to facilitate buying more testing supplies and trying to get more testing going. He said yesterday, we're at about 22,000 tests a day. He wants to double that. And experts have said we've got to get to that higher level of testing, and testing has to get more accurate for us to really get a grip and handle this virus and try to stop the spread.
Karen, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for asking.
Sure, a lot to go through there. And we do want to remind you again that Governor DeWine is coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock with his news conference. We'll bring it to you live here on 91.7 WVXU. I've been talking with Ohio State House correspondent Karen Kassler. Thanks for listening. The coronavirus pandemic has affected so many aspects of our lives, not the least of which is the economy. Marketplace has produced a special series of programs, The Economy, What Now? It looks at various ways it has changed and what we might expect in the future. WVXU will air the next in the series this coming Tuesday at 7 in the evening. It's called Reimagining the Economy. Marketplace Morning Report's David Brancaccio hosts the program, and he talked with me earlier this morning about what he learned. Hello, David.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Happy to have you here today. We've been missing you on the Marketplace Morning Report. When are you coming back?
Coming back Monday, which means those hours again, which actually I'm a morning person. It's great. Yeah, Monday.
Well, tell us where the idea for this series came about. Why did you decide to take a look at all of this?
Well, I had heard about this idea called the Overton Window. It's named after a public policy guy from Michigan. I think it's Joseph P. Overton. But it's just the idea that once in a while, the window of public policy possibilities widens. Things that were considered totally off the table, we can't even talk about that in a serious way, in certain situations like crisis, can be discussed in a real way. Here's an example. How many stories have I done about universal basic income? The idea that the government might just send checks to some people to create a floor on their income to people, to keep people out of desperate situations. We did stories. They test it. Does it hurt the impulse to want to work? The data generally is that it does not. But are you ever going to get a universal basic income? I mean, even if Elon Musk at Tesla, he's been calling for one of these things. So now we've had one. That's what those $1,200 checks were that the government was handing out. Do we need one more routinely for some people? So it's a moment where your audience and people around the country may want to engage, you know, new ideas for making the economy better than it was in February. Now, February, before pandemic, there was, quote, full employment. Perfect for everybody? It's not perfect for everybody. Widening income inequality, gaps between different people in terms of opportunity. The renewed energy of the social justice movement has, right, underscored the fact that there are structural problems that get in the way of people's success, including racism. So if I could talk to anybody in the country about, okay, what's a better idea? What's a different idea? Why not do that? And we ended up with a good start to that conversation, not just universal basic income, but for instance, I talked to a scholar who talks about why can't we have a big old sovereign wealth fund? The government has this big pile of money, like Harvard University's endowment, only mega. Norway has one based on its North Sea oil reserves. Well, why couldn't we have one? Not based on oil, but he proposes, as you know, interest rates are near zero. He proposes the government borrow like mad, invest in stocks, bonds, property on the market, and then lets that portfolio grow. And since it would be public money, we, the public, would be entitled to perhaps getting cash outs from that. Let's say we want to start a business when we're 21 or want to use some of the money to further our education. There'd be this big endowment, a citizens' wealth fund, he calls it. Interesting idea. It also means borrowing like mad, which will make a lot of people unhappy, mortgaging our future, some will say, but I think worth discussing. And so that's included in The Economy Reimagined.
Now, has there ever been this kind of a big reset in the American economy ever before?
It's hard to find parallels. You think about the Great Depression, which created a lot of the institutions that we live with today. It's usually crisis. You want to say it's an opportunity, but we don't have any choice but to rethink things. And you want to say once in a lifetime, once in a generation, it's a once in a really long time when we can talk more seriously about some of this. You know, even stuff that it's not too shocking, Democrats and Republicans agree we need to build a ton of infrastructure, which would create a ton of jobs, yet we can't quite seem to get around to authorizing all this. There are experts who say now is the time for that.
How do you think the economy will look different Obviously, there are going to be some changes. You talk about a variety of things in the special, which will be airing next Tuesday evening. But coming out of this, do you think there'll be anything similar to what we had in February before the pandemic hit?
I mean, a lot has been written, of course, about just the fact that we've learned that we can do many jobs, but not all jobs, from home or in a distanced way. The airlines have to be worried about the fact that, really, is a salesperson ever going to do that one-day trip from Chicago to New York to do sales calls and then fly back that night again? Those are going to be Zoom calls from now on. So there's structural changes like that. But the idea that even had there not even been a pandemic, there would have been a big challenge for jobs in America, just not quite as quickly. This is with the challenge of new technology, artificial intelligence, software, automation, will radically change the American workforce. Now, you know, in Stardate 5126.3, as Captain Kirk might say, it might mean more and better jobs for more people in the end. But there's nobody who says it will not be highly disruptive in the near term. So these are issues we had to address anyway. And it may be that the pandemic is forcing the timeline of this to happen even earlier.
Now, there's been some talk about the social bond, raising funds for projects that create a positive social outcome. Do you anticipate that that will happen?
Social bonds actually are already popular during pandemic. Some really big philanthropies, you know, they have all this money anyway, but they want to increase their grant making to help deal with this crisis, have used social bonds. As we get investors through Wall Street who want to lend money, invest in projects that make the world a better place. They do get a return. You know, it's not like they're doing it for free or completely out of the kindness of their hearts, but they do it to, one of the goals is to make the world a better place. So we talked to someone who has long experience, just for instance, on economic development on Native American lands. And she talks about how social bonds in partnership with tribes could finally bring about things that need to get done. I mean, getting broadband internet across reservations, broadband internet really anywhere in the United States that doesn't have it, fixing roads, clean drinking water. Social bonds are a really interesting opportunity right now. And, you know, and then we say pandemic, renewed energy in the social justice movement right now. The greatest economic collapse of my lifetime, and I'm not young, but also climate change. And so in the Reimagining special, we also address that. Of course we do, in two different ways. We have someone who has worked on a report that says it's plausible to decarbonize the entire U.S. economy in 15 years, 1-5, not 50, but 15 years. That would cause wrenching changes to people in the existing energy industry. But the calculation is we would create many more and better jobs by doing something like that. And there's also something called the circular economy. You don't just think about renewable energy. You think about renewable everything, which is very interesting, more than a thought experiment, really. But in your part of the world, it's interesting. I talked to a California congressman, okay, represents Silicon Valley. He wants to bring Silicon Valley more toward you. Why should Silicon Valley only be in these traditional tech hubs? How do you get it to Appalachia? How do you get it to the American South? Well, broadband for sure everywhere, but also partnering with lots of colleges and universities. He talks about tech industry has been traditionally very myopic about reaching out to the talent that's elsewhere spread across the country. So this notion of spreading the good jobs of the future out of the norm, the places that you would expect the tech jobs to be, I think is a really interesting initiative that could change people's lives if we get the policy right.
Well, we look forward to the program. Again, we're going to be airing it on Tuesday at 7 in the evening here on 91.7. David, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it was great. Thank you so much.
I've been talking with Marketplace Morning Report's David Brancaccio about the special series, The Economy, What Now? The next installment again Tuesday at 7 on 91.7 WVXU, talking about reimagining the economy. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Producer for today's show was Selena Reeder. Today's technical director was Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks.